Hello, I'm Nicholas Barrett.
I'm Maria de Meredes.
I'm Nicholas Poitier.
And I'm Marta Dominguez Jimenez.
And you're listening to The Sound of Economics. Welcome to a special episode about the myths of economics. Today, we're going to be looking at three ideas that we might believe to be true, or at least possible, but aren't. Later, we're going to be discussing common misconceptions related to the Chinese economy and trade deficits. But for many people, our first myth isn't a matter of if, it's a matter of when. First on our list today, robots will take all our jobs. Nicholas, what's stopping robots from taking all our jobs?
So, I mean, this is a story that's been around since forever, basically. It's called in economics a lump of labor fallacy. So this is the idea that there's a lump, so like a pile of labor that has to be performed. And if some kind of automation or some kind of redistribution of labor takes this labor away from workers, they will be unemployed and they will be unhappy. This term was described the first time in the 1890s by Frederick Schlosser. But the first instance that's kind of generally associated to this are the Luddites, which kind of destroyed factories. There were weavers that were afraid that basically the invention of the automatic weaving machine or the automatic spinning machine will destroy their jobs and they will have nothing to do, so they destroyed the things. And this has been come over and over again. There's like John Maynard Keynes talked about it, and now it's again up in the topics, this belief that automation will destroy jobs. And the general economic sense, if you ask labor economists, then most of them are quite skeptical of this automation story. And the reason is that actually we don't believe that unemployment is due to a lump of labor that has to be performed, but it's actually a question of prices and of the incentives and the structural imbalances we have in the economy. So if we look at the evolution of labor, if we go back to like the pre-industrial age, 80% of people in the 18th century, I looked up the number, so yes, it's a classical structural chain story. 18th century, 80% of labor would be in agriculture. And if you go to someone in the 18th century and tell them, in 200 years, there will be basically no one working on fields anymore. Now it's below 2% for the US and Europe. They would be really scared. They would say, what would all these people do if they don't work on the field? What would they do? And actually, the story is that first they started working in the manufacturing industry, producing all this kind of good that we have now, which we'll later talk about how this shifted to Asia. And now we're not working in manufacturing anymore. So manufacturing peaked in the 1940s and 50s, in the US around 40% of employment, and now it's less, it's around 20%. So if you talk to someone in the 1940s, there will be no manufacturing in the US anymore, everyone will be freaked out, what would we do? And actually now there's many, many service jobs. My favorite example is the invention of the coffee vending machine was in 1947, and now there are more baristas than ever been. So there's like a reallocation of the evolution of our goods we buy and things we buy.
So Maria, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, it actually, you know, it's about how do we see innovation, should be afraid of innovation, how does innovation help us transform the economy, right? And I mean, first of all, we should not be afraid of innovation. I think innovation is the order of the day and it will always be the case. You have efficiency gains as you innovate, but also you have necessary transformation as you innovate. I mean, you know, the chains in productions in manufacturing has always been an efficiency gain. Yes, jobs were lost. So you have immediate effects as you transform. Somebody will win and somebody would lose, but you also adapt. So the next generation of employment will have different skills to meet the needs of the day. So it's a myth, in the sense that you don't only worry about how jobs are lost as you innovate, because you need to simply account for the fact that your economy will adapt and you will get new skills to meet the new innovative demands. So I think that's the reason why this is a myth in my way, and I think that's actually a good point.
So the way I've always kind of interpreted it is obviously approximately 70 years ago, John Maynard Keynes estimated that by now we'd be working a few hours a week, not many at all. And that would be because of efficiency gains, and it would take so little effort, thanks to technology, for us to basically run the kind of society that we needed to survive. I suppose the counter to that is something philosophers call the hedonic treadmill, which is that whatever happens to you, however good or bad your life gets, your expectations immediately adjust to that. So even if you have a much better standard of material living, you instantly want, well, after a month or so, you want a slightly better one. And so our expectations have just been kind of endless, and that has helped us have endless growth and endless job creation.
It's difficult to make predictions of that sort, because when you try to make a prediction, you have a very specific model of how the economy operates. But actually, if you're making a prediction about 100 years from now, you just don't know what kind of needs you're going to have in 100 years from now, very much like the agricultural needs 200 years ago. You could just couldn't see that. And it's easy to get afraid if you say that, you know, the efficiency gains on agriculture is going to mean that nobody works in agriculture. That's probably true, and it is true as the numbers that Nicholas just gave us. However, all those people that were working in agriculture are now somewhere else, and therefore isn't necessarily a direct loss, or necessarily a direct loss. There are losses, but there's also transformations. And I think that's an important thing to sort of try and price in, and that's what makes it impossible to make predictions, because you cannot identify what these needs will be, or indeed the skills that we will need for the future.
And I think the other thing is that innovation results in a very direct increase in productivity, which results in a very direct increase in incomes, which then drives demand and creates demand for other types of jobs. And indeed, a study of the American economy, I think it was 1982 to 2012, found that, in fact, the greatest increase in employment related to the technological areas that had been developing. So technology does not replace labor in that sense, but it creates a greater need for labor in those industries that are developing, that are higher value added. And yes, it's what Maria says, there will certainly be transformation, and there are jokes that, you know, we will get to a future where everyone's either a life coach or a yoga instructor. I mean, I think that's highly unlikely, but certainly we cannot predict the jobs of the future.
Well, it's about the services. I mean, the yoga instructors are really part of the services. It will be difficult to robotize services. There is talk about that. But the need for services, certainly in aging population, will always be there. So, if you were to be daring enough to make a prediction, it would be difficult to think that these jobs will actually decrease. I suspect they might increase. That's a transformation in this respect. The more difficult part is on the production side, when you're talking about, you know, what we produce, the goods that we consume. Will they still be produced by people, or will it be just robots? And what would that mean for the future of employment? That's more difficult.
So a few years ago, I interviewed the anthropologist David Graeber, and he wrote a rather famous book called On the Phenomenon of Bullshit Jobs, which is about sort of predicated on a survey that 40% of British workers thought their job either made no difference to the world whatsoever or made it slightly worse, and that they were just getting no satisfaction from their jobs whatsoever. So I suppose one element of this conversation should be the quality of work. Mm-hmm. Because when I think of AI and automation, I think about the supermarkets in South London, which have automated checkouts. And there'll be 8 automated checkout machines, and there'll be one guy standing in the middle who comes over to confirm you're over 18 to buy alcohol, or comes over to iron out all the human errors. And he's got a job, but it's really bad, and I'd hate to have that job. He's just standing there all day dealing with these things. So another element, I think, is the quality of people's work and whether people are going to enjoy it, whether we're just going to be tidying up after algorithms in the future, even if we are all employed. And I guess the second is, I suppose people want to believe in this myth, because the alternative to a world of almost full employment, I mean, the exact opposite of that would be a world where everything's automated and we just live lives completely defined by leisure and fun. Should we be aiming to have a world without work? And if you could flick a switch and you could have a sustainable world without work, would you flip it?
I mean, these are not small questions, but I think that the quality of work that you described, I mean, if I just look at objective criteria, I think the quality of most of our jobs today are much better than the quality of the jobs 150 years ago. Think of coal mines, how many people were in coal mines, even agriculture. So, I mean, if that is a measure, I mean, it's difficult to believe that we are not better now than we were 100 years ago.
Oh, but surely you can apologise for anything by comparing it to the past. It's still not a completely pleasant life to be running around an Amazon warehouse, having everything you do timed but and measured and analysed and scrutinised and watched.
But I also think another thing is that, you know, the studies now say that what automation is leading to is job polarization, which is basically the best jobs and the worst jobs will survive and everything in the middle won't. But actually the historical precedent for that is there as well. So if we look at, you know, the point of the Luddites was not only that machines were going to take their jobs, but actually it was craftsmen who had trained and had a specific skill, and that skill was suddenly made absolutely obsolete. But I think throughout time, certainly, we cannot say, if there's one thing industrialization did is develop the middle class and not eliminate it. So I think we should be, you know, a bit more cautious about these things. And the other thing is that if you look at the early industrial period, the average real wage in the UK didn't really grow. It was fluctuating around the same value for about 50 years. And then after that, it began to take off. So if, again, we now think that we are in a kind of new industrial revolution, then the president once more would be that. Of course, I'm not saying there will be an absolute historical repetition, but I think, you know, this is all stuff we have heard before. Mm.
It's fair for me to clarify that nobody around this table would dismiss automation as an issue because it's going to disrupt entire industries and sectors. And millions of people will presumably have to retrain or redefine themselves in the job market.
And just to say that when you say the quality of our living, because you made a point on that, the quality of our living is not defined only by our jobs. So you're thinking about safety nets and how to organize societies. That is much more than just about jobs, right? So if you want to give an answer to the question, you know, is the quality of life going to improve? It's not just about the way we work. It's more than that. So I think that's an important part.
Sorry, if I may jump in here, I will restrain from any comments about bullshit books. I will just say that I think this theory is not really based on any. It's like a nice theory, but I think that's about it. So if you actually look at the quality, and Maria already said that, of jobs, it has improved constantly. Like, everyone would prefer to be a checkout watcher to be a miner in like the 18th century. I think there is no question about that. And furthermore, I think this is also an example about what wages, the importance that wages play. So something as a European, if you travel to, for instance, US, what you always notice is the prevalence of probably what David Graeber would call bullshit jobs. So you go there and there's, instead of having like turnpipes at the entrance of a metro station, you have someone that clicks your things by hand or something like this. There's many, many jobs. There's someone in the supermarket packing your bags. And this has to do with wages. And this is basically the baseline thing. If wages are low, it makes sense. If you don't really have to pay someone much, you can actually have someone that packs your bag. If you're in a very high wage environment like UK, like Switzerland, you cannot afford to have someone in Switzerland packing your bag. So it will be automated away. So automation is not just about the technical abilities that we have, but also about the relative wages.
Mm. Okay, so let's move on. So our next myth, myth number two, is something I think I actually believed myself, or at least something I perhaps took for granted without thinking about too much. Our next myth, trade deficits are bad. Nicholas, surely trade deficits are bad. Nobody wants a trade deficit.
So I think the first part is, so there are two parts of this answer. And the first part is the actually trade deficit for a country. I will step back for that for a second. The second part is bilateral trade deficit. So if you listen to Donald Trump for a bit longer, he talks a lot about the bilateral trade deficit between China and the US.
So you mean the difference between the trade deficit from the entire country and how much they trade with the world and the trade deficit between two specific countries, say America and China?
Yes. And everyone agrees that bilateral trade, in economics, most people believe bilateral trade deficit are actually not important. And the example I want to give here is the iPhone. So we think if we look at the bilateral trade, we will see that an iPhone is traded from China to the US. But actually, very, very little of the value of the iPhone is actually created in China. So just 2% of the sales price of the iPhone is in China. 60% is profit by Apple itself. And then you have much higher value added from Korea, from Japan, countries that by themselves, they provide the chips, they provide the displays, and they are produced with IP from the US, with chemicals from Germany. So there's many, many things in the thing that China exports to the US that are actually not Chinese. So the second part is the trade deficit. And basically, most economists believe that trade deficits are largely driven by differences in capital flows and not in trade flows.
Let me ask the question slightly differently. So if you believe for a minute that trade deficits are bad, do you necessarily also believe that trade surpluses are good? Okay, this is an important difference. And if I might just take, we talk about current accounts, actually. Current accounts is the balance between savings and investment, and it's mostly driven by the trade. So a country, how much a country saves and how much a country invests domestically, right? Okay, so all of us save, we have money in the bank accounts. Collectively, where does this money go? Right? Does it stay in investment projects in the country or does it go abroad, right? Now, if you save more than you invest, right, domestically in one country, that means that the money that remains the surplus, it's either money under the mattress or it is invested abroad, right? So it brings benefits somewhere, it's just not you. I mean, in the country itself, right? So the question is, if you have a deficit here, that means that you are saving less than you're investing, then where does this come from and is it a good thing? And if it's a surplus, then why are you not investing domestically, right? I mean, what is it that you need? Why is it that you cannot cover, use all the funds you have to promote the welfare of your domestic thing? So, and there is a difference also with this, the bilateral thing. So the relationship between two countries is a different thing than the world relationship. Obviously, the whole world will have a trade balance. Yeah, if you think about the trade, you cannot export things more than you import things from the Mars, right? I mean, at the end of the day, this has to be zero. But the bilateral things, what do they mean? If you spend more than you save, at some point, you're going to have a problem, right? If you have a persistent deficit over and over again as a country, well, at some point you need to pay back. I mean, where are you going to get the money to pay back, right? I mean, so if you have persistent deficits, you have to understand what this means about the sustainability of your finances, right? And in economics, there are a number of conditions which are going to make this question less relevant. Let's say the US, why can the US afford to have persistently a deficit and not get into any kind of trouble? The US is not in trouble. It has had a deficit for a very long time. Why is that? Whereas countries like in the Eurozone who had persistent deficits, like Greece, Spain, Portugal, those countries that had huge deficits, why did they get into trouble? Right? What's the difference and why is it one relevant and the other one isn't? And the US has got the dollar and everybody wants the dollar. So everybody's ready to get dollars and pay good money to the US. So the US is winning by what they call the seniorage, basically the privilege of having internationally used currency, the benefits of which can be used to sustain a prolonged deficit. Whereas other countries didn't have that, and therefore, if you do have a prolonged deficit, at some point you would get into trouble. But what does it mean then about the surplus? I mean, obviously, those countries that have persistent deficits are being financed, and typically by the same countries for those that have persistent surpluses. So if you think there is almost a responsibility of the surplus countries lending money to those that have persistent deficits, that's one thing. So I think that's important not to sustain prolonged surpluses in order for those who have deficits not to sustain prolonged deficits. But the other hand is that domestically, you have to ask the question, why am I exporting my capital to other countries persistently? It's one thing to do it once, to do it twice. But if you think of the history of those countries that have surpluses, they have had them sustainably, right? And the question is why? Why is it that the country cannot absorb its own money domestically? And that's an interesting thing that we're facing. It is a real problem in some countries in Europe. We have this problem, and we need to ask the questions. Is it necessary for countries to have prolonged surpluses in the future? And I think the myth here is not so much on the deficit side as it is on the surplus side. So I personally believe that you cannot have sustained deficits unless the US, in which case you have a specific role coming from the dollar. But in any other country, sustained deficits can be problematic. And there are important reasons in economics, but I don't want to go into them now. I think you need to think about that. Even as a household, you cannot have a sustained deficit. But the question is, for you to have a sustained deficit, somebody else has to have a sustained surplus. And this is that's a myth that we need to bust. The fact that sustained surpluses are necessarily a good thing, that I don't think is true.
Great. Well, let's move on to our third myth of the podcast. Our third myth. China has a huge economy because China has a huge population.
So the myth here is basically not... So it's certainly true that the reason that the Chinese economy is big as a whole is because there's a lot of population. So the myth is more about what is the reason for the growth miracle. And you see this as a talking point over and over repeated, not just by politicians, but also by economists, that they say China is so important or so successful because they have a lot of cheap labor. And while it is true that the reason is why American companies or European companies expatriate the operations to China is because wages in China are lower than in Europe, the million-dollar question in economic development is not why do companies go from Europe to China. I mean, there's always been a wage differential between poor countries and rich countries. The reason is why does these companies go to China or why does this happen to China and to much less extent to India and not at all in most African countries. And if you look at that, it has actually very little to do with the amount of labor available, but actually with the amount of capital available. And this is the classical East Asian development model, which is very high savings rate, a stable institutional environment. And then in China, starting in the 1970s, with opening of special economic zones, which are mostly cities and regions in the coastal area of China, where you could actually trade very freely and also have more free capital flows, which attracted investors. There's estimates around 54% of Chinese growth between the 70s and the 2000s was due to capital accumulation alone. TFP, so productivity growth, just 2 to 3% growth rate per year, so maybe a third of growth. And actually, the amount of people, population growth, because of the one-child policy, has played a minor, if not negative, role in this.
Hmm. So it's not so much that this is it's necessarily a myth that Chinese huge population has contributed to its incredible economic growth. It's that saying that that's the main factor completely underplays lots of very clever and decisive policies enacted by the Politburo in Beijing.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, the scale certainly plays a role in the sense that when you have sort of a lot of capital accumulating in a very big country, then quite clearly you can do things with the capital, right? And that is going to help the economy grow. And this is, I mean, when Nicholas talks about capital accumulation, so the Chinese saved a lot of money. That money stayed in China and got invested. Right? I mean, you know, the Chinese are now many universities. They're really pioneers in technological terms in a number of sectors that are of relevance in now and in the future. So, you know, China has invested. And that is a choice. And when you have the scale and the money, that's going to make a difference at the global level. A small country that has a lot of savings cannot simply make the same investments simply because it's small, right? So there is a scale thing there. But, I mean, there's a number of things that contributed. I mean, Nicholas talked about the institutional environment. That is correct. We think of China as a non-democracy. It's not a democratic sense, a democratic country in the same sense that we have it in the Western world. But it is stable, and that's important for investments. So investment will be drawn there. But then, of course, a strategic decision that China took in the early 2000s to join the global system, saying that I'm opening up my borders, you can come in, I can come to you, but also I'm going to play by the rules being the global multilateral system. All of these things contribute to China exploiting its scale to become the current miracle.
So as far as I understand it, China basically intentionally devalued its own currency so it could flood the West with cheap goods. And when it got all the money from those exports, instead of investing in its own population, it lent that money back to the West to create a kind of long-term stream of revenue. Is that correct?
Well, I mean, okay, so let's before we become judgmental, I think it's important. I think it's important to understand.
I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. That is playing by the rules. The stuff that Washington complains about not playing by the rules is intellectual property theft.
Yes. So, okay. So again, many issues here. I mean, I think it's important to sort of try and dissect them a little bit because it's just too much. Whether China is a currency manipulator, that is a whole new topic we can talk about. It is true that China adapted policies that promoted its own good. Okay?
Like everyone else.
But you can only do it up that to a level, right? And if you do it beyond that level, then others start complaining because you say, no, maybe you're exploiting things that we've agreed we're not going to do. And, you know, things like currency manipulation is an issue to be discussed. Competition is another thing to discuss. Why do you, what you called about intellectual theft, you know, you ask people who come into your country to give you their technology, but when you go to their country, you don't give your technology to them. These are issues that this is the rule book. And unfortunately, the global rule book is not as detailed as that, right? So the global rule book relies on a philosophy. And the Western philosophy have a way of understanding each other. Now you have a new player that has a different way of doing things, and therefore we're going to complain. So all of this, I'm sure, have contributed to the rise of China. And we are now at a level that we actually think that China is exploiting us a little bit. And that's what Mr. Trump, but also Europe, complains about. It's not just Mr. Trump on that. So what we need to think about now is what happens next. Are we still going to be able to engage with China, which, you know, all the trade issues tell us we should? But on whose rules are we going to do it? Our rules, in which case we need to write them very carefully, or on Chinese rules? And this is very much in flux right now. It's a very big discussion on issues of competition. China has certainly adopted policies to promote itself, and the question is it fair?
Marta, what's going to happen next?
Well, I just wanted to say, based on the currency, that yes, at some point there might have been manipulation to keep a currency cheap, but in fact, if we look at the last decade, it's almost the opposite. Currently, the Chinese currency is overpriced. There has been recent devaluation, but that's more in line with its with its real value, and from a real effective exchange rate standpoint, it is overpriced. And indeed, there was an appreciation of the currency up until kind of 2015 that was, if anything, manufactured to appreciate and not the opposite. But beyond that, back to the savings rate, I think the degree to which the Chinese savings rate is enormous is something that maybe doesn't always transcend the conversation. And we're talking about the savings rate. It's fallen now a little bit. It's at about 47-46%. It was above 50 for many years. And even since the 70s, it's been quite high. It's been around the 40s, which is, you know, the U.S. savings rate is 20%. The European savings rate is 25%. So we're talking about very high values. And I think the institutional angle is also quite important compared to other developing countries. People talk about microfinance all the time, but there's also a kind of micro savings discussion. And institutionally, China made it very easy for its citizens to save. It not manufactured a high savings rate, but it, you know, its policy was based on trying to encourage a high savings rate, and that certainly made a significant difference.
If I may say to that, I just remember that the Chinese welfare state is not as developed as let's say the European welfare state. So there is a need also for savings to, you know, cater for things that otherwise the state would cater. So I think that also plays into explaining perhaps the abnormal saving rates in China.
Why do we think these reductive myths about China prevail?
I think China is a big player. It's a new player. It's a player that doesn't necessarily follow the same business models that we do. We don't know China. This is the thing about Europe. And here, differentiates with the US. The US has studied China more than we have. But still, there's a lot to know about this. And it is a big country. 1.4 billion Chinese. We are 500 with the UK. The US is 350. Together, the Western bloc is a little bit Western. I mean, there's other countries as well. But the US and the EU and the UK are just above half of China. That in itself gives you a fear of the potential of China. And I mean, and of course, there will be the US, I'm sure, is worried about its supremacy.
Yeah, if I may add to this, I think it's basically, I agree, very much agree with Maria just said. It's like we don't understand China. It's like a combination of our fear. I mean, if you ask anyone, of 1.3 billion people, it sounds scary. We have this kind of, still this kind of racial stereotype of the Asian hordes coming. It's kind of a thing you see still portrayed. If you look at newspaper headlines these days, at the front pages, they are quite dehumanizing pictures often. And then there's just also the Chinese propaganda. It's a communist economy that pretends that the workers are the thing. There's this myth of the communal spirit of the Confucian philosophy and all this kind of things. This contribute to this kind of imaginary role of the mass of Chinese workers, when actually it's very difficult for us conceptualize. And that actually capital in this communistic country, capital played such an important role in forging the growth.
Okay, so there you have it, three myths and three myths debunked, I hope. Well, I hope our listeners enjoyed this rather experimental podcast. Do get in touch if you have any myths of your own. If there's something strange on the finance page, who are you going to call? Not us, but you can send an email if you want. We don't need any of that. But thank you very much for listening, and do subscribe if you liked it.